Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 487. Please join us at Meltdown every other week for Beta Test, which is a show that I started to essentially write new material because comics need new material. And I'm not getting to go on the road as much just currently with my schedule. So I said, hey, what if three comics each did 20 minutes of new material? And then we'll make it free so that people don't have to pay to watch workshop jokes. But it's fun. Were you there last night, Kyle?
I was like, you're standing, so I wanted to stand too.
Oh, that's right.
I missed yours because I was getting interviewed for something.
You son of a bitch.
I know, but it's a super fun show. It's insane. You get to see three funny people work on stuff.
Jen Kirkman was there last night, and Mike Kaplan. And the week before it was Bronger and Jackie Cation.
Putting together material that already sounds done.
Yeah, so it'll be every other Monday. If you go to nerdmeltla.com.
If you want to make an evening of it, you can come to my open mic and then stick around and see Chris's show.
Yeah, oh, nice.
We're a
little backdoor
header.
Plug in there for the open mic. Yes. So again, tickets are free. Sign up, and then even when it sells out, there's usually a standby list because people will sign up and then not like people just squat on tickets. And so there's
show in particular, it's easy to just keep piling them in the back.
Yeah, we can pile. What we've been there, 3,000 people, 4,000 people.
I mean, on a good night. Yeah.
it's really
hopping.
So that's Beta Test at Nerdist Showroom at Meltdown Nerd Melt. It's at Nerd Melt on Twitter. Yep. We call it. This episode of the podcast is Andy Daly. His new show, Review, which is really funny, premieres on Comedy Central tomorrow night, March 6th at 10 p.m. Really, really... Andy Daly is one of the funniest human beings alive.
That's true.
Just watching him on stage, he has that same thing that, like, Will Ferrell, Kristen Wiig, Fred Armisen, it's just... They just lock into a character and just juice it. For every delicious
he's
bit
one of those
pulp.
People who you look and he comes on, you're like, oh, he's gonna be funny.
Exactly.
You just get excited because you know you're
on.
About
yes,
to
totally,
laugh.
Totally. That you will, if I know he's gonna be on something, I'll either come back in the room or
I had
turn
this,
it on.
That on this podcast. I was really excited. I'm like, oh, he's gonna say silly stuff.
And he's great. So here we go. The Nerds Podcast number 487 with TV's Andy Daly.
Ooh.
That was a bad Andy Daly impersonation.
It was.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I apologize for the size and straightness of this banana.
It is an it's a large banana.
I almost want to report this banana to HR for sexual harassment. This is an uncomfortably large... I took a picture of it. It is... This is a really...
I had an odd moment. I ate a banana this morning, and it was like the way it was shaped more so than any other banana I noticed was just like... And I was by myself. I was like, it's like a dick. Yeah. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I saw a guy in his 30s and I felt real ashamed.
In his 30s?
Yeah, it's like, what am I doing making that joke by myself?
What are you getting to your 40s and you're still making that joke?
That is a particularly dick-like banana.
I think we're all going to agree.
As far as bananas go.
This is like, if a banana had a dick, it would be this. This is a banana's
Where's
dick.
It from? Was it Del Monte?
It is Del Monte.
Where do they make it? Ecuador?
Now I know where to go.
Yeah.
Now I know where to go to get the real dick-like bananas.
This banana's good, but do you have any more shaped like a dick?
Is there a banana that I could force my head down on in a movie theater, like just where I'm going? I'm
so
gonna
you hold it with one hand and then put
yeah,
your
and then
other
I
hand.
Go like I'm gonna stretch and then I just lightly. And by the way, I've poked the banana through a popcorn box at the same time.
That's a buttery banana.
That is.
Sounds like a good combo. Yeah.
You gonna butter
popcorn
that banana?
Banana. Yeah.
You gonna butter that?
Yeah.
Andy Daly, it is delightful to have you on
Thank
the podcast.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah, man.
We adore you. Oh. And I'm very excited that you're doing At Midnight, and I'm excited that you have a new show that's coming on.
It's all happening. It's literally all happening. I can't think of a thing that's not happening.
You and
Try. You can't.
Good luck. I feel like you and I were always in the same sort of a boat, I think, of like just getting, being fortunate enough to like pop up on a lot of things, but then a lot of those things like don't get picked up or something happens and it's all out of your control. And it's like,
right.
finding the right thing that showcases what it is that you do so that people can see, like, oh, this guy's really good at what he does.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I feel like there, I've picked up a lot of voices here and there going, this guy needs his own show. This guy needs his own show. And so there's a little bit of it's excitement, but also pressure. Now I have my own show, and let's see if they feel like they were right.
Take it back.
Once they take it back. Take it back. He didn't need his own show. He was fine popping up in other people's things.
March 2008, I said Andy Daly needed his own show. I'm going to retract that.
Well, and it's also like trying to figure out, you know, because you do so many types of things and so many different types of characters, and you can be funny just as yourself, but then, you know, like something like Nine Sweaters or something where you're performing, you know, you're going to UCB or Meltdown and doing characters.
Great record.
You do amazing characters as well. I mean, like, I guess I can understand why the business would go, like, well, what do we do with it? Like, what do we do with this guy? Does he lead a show? Do we make him a friend? Does it a crazy variety show?
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I have two careers in a way. Like, there's my Eastbound and Down career where it's like I'm playing characters who are closer to myself and aren't like big C characters. And then there's like the Nine Sweaters sort of comedy bang bang and Mad TV part of it where, you know, I'm doing sketch comedy characters. And it's, I don't want to try to play that game where I marry those two, you know, like Martin Short had a TV show where he was a sketch comedy actor who came home and then had a family. It's stuff like that. It's an awkward fit. Yeah. So, you know, it's to me about right now, I think I'm going down that Eastbound and Down route more with Review and playing the sketch comedy characters where I can, you know, in different formats.
Yeah.
The first time I ever saw you was at M-Bar.
Oh yeah,
In the original comedy Death Ray days.
Yeah, yeah.
Before it was even called Death Ray.
Before it was called Death Ray,
and the
first
thing, Ember,
the first thing I ever saw you do, which I just quoted in our At Midnight meeting today, was the old man who's doing comedy. And it's a VC. You say, well, I don't want to be obnoxious and quote your bit back to you, but it's a thing about the VCR.
Yeah. It's right. There's someone comes up and says, hey, my grandfather is a like.
Well, we said the intro is always that this guy's an old man and he's going to try stand up for the first time in his life. It's a lifelong dream of his to do stand up comedy, and his grandchildren are here in the audience, which
that's
is really
right.
sweet.
That's
always say that. That's important. And
so let's hear it for him. Be real supportive. Let's hear it for him. And then I come up and it's just a slew of the filthiest fucking jokes that are all sort of old man specific. My daughter got me a VCR for Christmas. I don't know how to program it, so I just stick my cock in it and fuck it.
But then you have to see your face afterwards.
Waiting for the
look to the What do you think of that?
The first character I saw you do was, I brought up this show a bunch.
And by the way, when I first started doing that joke, it wasn't that weird for somebody to have a VCR.
A timestamp. Yeah. Now it's, and so now I feel like the joke's really evolved. Like, it got me an MP3 player.
I did. At some point, I changed it to a DVD player. It just doesn't work. You can't picture somebody sticking their dick in a DVD.
It's harder.
Now you got to do Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I remember I saw you when I used to go to a Besser's show at iOS. They did every Wednesday called Pricks, Punks, Perverts, and People. And I brought the show up a ton of times because every week it was you, Jerry Minor, David Koechner, Patton Oswalt, Brian Posehn, Jamie Denbo, and Daniel Schneider.
And Matt Besser would always do a set, and Horatio would sometimes pop up.
Yeah, Horatio would be there a lot. And so it was just like, and this was every week. If that show existed today.
Nobody was ever there for
I was there almost every week by myself.
Yeah.
Single ticket, please. Yes, again. And then Brian would see me and go, sorry, I don't have anything new. New? Why would you have something new? It's only been a week. And I got to see your characters, which the first one I saw was Life of the Party, Inc.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a guy that like left a corporate job to become like a professional like party maker. Not like a guy that you would put on a party, but a guy that would show up to parties to make it more lively.
If you're worried that your party is not going to be great, you hire this guy and he'll come and be the life of the party.
Yeah. And what was the thing about like it's like different types of partying and like it's like interesting conversation.
Well, the main thrust of it is it's just the worst guy in the world to do it because he's a complete belligerent, intolerant asshole from the second he walks in the door. I show up, I put down my fucking boombox, and we get started. And we dance. You got to get up and dance. Tell me you don't want to dance. So, he runs through the different styles of parties. I could do a conversation party. you know.
Yeah, that was my favorite one, where it's like politics, and like it was like you would just, no matter what, you just yell at the guy to get their head out of their ass.
Yeah. Well, the starting point for that bit, I was at the Crunch Gym at the Sunset Five, not to, you know, gym drop, but I and there was a guy walking around with a big smile on his face carrying a Bush Cheney poster, and it was this was back in 2000, and you know, you don't normally carry like a political placard through a gym, but he was like talking to people like, hey, you gonna watch the debate tonight and stuff like that, and then his conversation would be, and it's like, of course, a very liberal environment there. Conversations that he'd get in with people would start cordial, and immediately he would start yelling at them, like within three lines. And it happened a couple of times, and then they escorted him out. And I later learned that was the guy Melrose Larry Green.
Oh, no way! Oh,
shit, Melrose Larry! Larry. Yeah,
that's who he was.
Is he still alive?
This was 2000.
Has he ever been?
But that idea amused me, of somebody just saying, I'll get into it. I'm a great conversationalist. What do you want to talk about? And then within three sentences going, get your head out of your ass! Pick up a fucking paper! Look at the record!
That's what he was yelling at the gym.
Look at the record of Texas Governor Ray. Look at the record!
I'm just trying to do the elliptical machine.
Yeah.
I'm working on flies. You don't want to think about this thing.
Yeah.
Did you start improv at UCB or with sketch? Because you also do a lot of the ASCAT shows as well.
Yeah. I know. I did sketch in college and as much improv as I could, but you know, there wasn't not so much was known about long form improv in those days. Like, you know, improv wasn't as out there as it is now. So when I graduated college, I moved to New York, and the UCB wasn't there yet. There was just some short form improv groups, and I got as involved as I could with that stuff. And did a short form show, six shows a week, for 2 years, doing just exclusively like Whose Line Is It Anyway, short form style improv, before the UCB came to town. And then I saw their ASCAT show and just was like, okay, I need to, that's it for me now. I need to know exactly how that is done and do that, because the possibilities of that, when you're not popping backstage to put on a silly coat and a crazy pair of glasses to come out and play a character, like to just be able to do it all in full view of the audience and be in total agreement with each other. Like, I just had to know how they accomplished that. And just create these long form stories that tie in. I mean, you know, I don't know. I wonder if people have that experience of coming to see an ASCAP for the first time, like I did, where it seems impossible.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem possible that these guys can get on the same page like that and know where one another is going and hold all these different ideas in their minds at the same time that they can come back to. I had to know how to do it. So I took the first class that they ever taught in New York, which was a workshop, one-day workshop with Matt Walsh. I was in that and have been doing it ever since.
Wow. Holy shit. But yeah. The one thing that all the UCB guys are great. I mean, like all the John Ross Bowies of the world and the mm-hmm. Sean Conroys.
Yeah.
And Owen Burke and all these people.
But John Daly.
And John Daly. Like, mm-hmm. It goes on and on. But there's something about, like, when I'm watching a show and I'm really not just trying to slobber all over your balls, but I'm going to.
Back to the banana.
Please move that banana.
But it's when you, like, especially during an ASCAT, when I see you come on, mm-hmm. I always feel this anticipation. It's like, can't wait to hear what you say, because there's a certain, and if anyone sees your character work or your improv, there's a certain effortlessness and a comfort, and you're immediately committed to what you're doing. Like, and there's nothing, sometimes with improv performers, over, there's a little bit of tentativeness mm-hmm. about like, we're sort of finding it. It's like when someone is singing and you hear them and they kind of have to arrive on the note versus like when someone just sticks the note, you know, like wow. You stick the note every time and you know, I know exactly what your character's point of view is and you're committed to it. And it's always a really fucking interesting choice that I never would have thought of.
Wow. Thank you. That's nice.
It's true. Like, you
now on the adverse side of that, when you, I don't like it when you're
the counterpoint. But I also, because usually when you watch comedy as a comedian, you're watching and go, yeah, I see how that guy got. I see how he got there. But you come from this place where I'm like, fuck, I never would have thought of that.
Wow. Yeah. And that's always fun to watch too.
Was that improv training? I know, because UCB's whole thing is like, you know, find the game. Like, what's the game? Like, mm-hmm. when you rip it apart, what's the game? Is that the underlying mechanism for you?
I think so, yeah. I think I just come at it from the same place we've all been trained to come at it. You know, mining a monologue, an ASCAD, you're mining the monologue for a scene premise. I mean, one thing that I often try to do is to come in with half of an idea. I don't know if that'll make sense, but just sort of come in with a character and a setting and an attitude and let the scene build from that point, rather than doing the full writerly work of coming up with what the scene is. I think if there's one way that I maybe think of myself differently from some other improvisers is that I really try not to think of myself as a writer who's on stage enacting his writing as much as, you know, maybe more of an actor who's committing a little bit more to the character and the scene and all that stuff. I think a lot of the time, certainly in the early New York days, it would feel like a stage full of writers who were not always even turning out to the audience. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, it was definitely a stylistic choice of mine early on to just say, whatever I'm doing, I'm going to commit to it as fully as if it was a written sketch or a play or something like that. Just like really try and act it.
Did you ever? Because obviously, if you're a sketch performer, it's not like there's a ton of sketch shows on television. I mean, like, you really at that time you could pretty much audition for MAD or SNL, and that was pretty much like occasionally you'd get a Dana Carvey show that would come along, but for the most part, sketch usually doesn't work on television.
Yeah,
or it'd be a group. Like a already set up pre-established group. Yeah.
So did you ever audition for any of the MAD?
I sure did. Yeah. Well, when I first came to New York, I did stage sketch shows. There were these couple of guys who are now, I think they just stepped down as the head writers of Letterman, but they were the Stengel brothers.
The Stengels, I know the Justin. You know, the Stengels, Justin and Eric Stengel. Great guys.
Yeah, those
really
are great guys. So in the early 90s, they put together a sketch showcase that was mainly like a writing showcase, but they had, you know, actors come in and do the sketches down at the West Beth Theater in the West Village. And I did that show, and then I did audition. I auditioned every year for MAD TV. I auditioned for the MAD TV pilot, and then just annually, I went over to Fox and auditioned. I auditioned for the Dana Carvey show and had a mind-blowing experience of getting a callback. And I guess, what year was that? I was
97, maybe?
I think so.
So I was like, if it was 97, I was 26, and I was just sitting around a round table with Dana Carvey and Louis C.K. and Robert Smigel and Dino Stamatopoulos. Jeez. And they were like, so what are your bits? It's crazy. That blew my mind.
But it blows my mind that you didn't get any of those shows.
You know, yeah. Well, those guys, I could tell. I mean, I walked out of that room going, they're not going to hire me. Like, I'm a little too green and I don't quite have these bits worked out. Like, I was like, well, I was thinking this might be funny and this might be funny. But based on that audition, Smigel recommended me to the Conan people, and I started doing bits on Conan. And Louie recommended me at Luna Lounge, and so myself and my comedy partner Andy Secunda started working out there. But then I ended up on MAD TV. I went every year, just annually I would go and get put on tape for MAD TV, and then one year they were like, I also auditioned for Saturday Night Live. That was the difference. I had a Saturday Night Live audition that I put everything into, everything I had. Like, I only had a week to work on it, but I did nothing else that week except focus full hard on that audition. And it went great, and I walked out going, I kind of don't care what happens, because that was the perfect Saturday Night Live audition that I could give at this time in my life. And I don't know, I got good feedback, but I don't know why I didn't get
it. Well, there's so many white dudes on the show when you audition as a white dude, then they're like, well, we already have five of those.
What year was that?
That was 99. Yeah, that was 99.
So that's like Koechner. Was that when Koechner got on there?
I think.
No, Koechner was before that.
Yeah, it might have been that Rachel Dratch was the only actor they hired that year.
Maybe. Oh, okay.
I don't know, but having done that, then the following year when MAD TV asked me to audition, I just had, like, I had a perfect audition basically. And so that made the difference of all those other years that I had auditioned for it.
Wow. And so what was that like?
What, MAD TV?
Yeah.
It's I've tried to figure out a good way to talk about it publicly. I fucked up so many times. Because look, it was great for me, and people still come up to me and recognize me from it and are excited to meet somebody from it. People love that show. So, and I should just, maybe sometimes I should just stop there and be thankful. Now, it was also a very hard competitive environment. I personally was not a fan of the show prior to getting hired onto it. You know, like, the way it worked out was that I auditioned for it every year, and then this one year they asked me to audition for it, and I went, and they were like, yeah, they really like you, they want you to come back. And so I watched it, and I had not watched it since the premiere, and I was just like, oh no, I don't see myself on there. I don't know what I could do on that show. I don't know how I could add to that show. But they asked me again, and then it turned into this weird thing where I was in LA, and they found out I was in LA and asked me to come in and audition, and I said no. And then I was in Chicago, and they found me backstage at this Chicago Improv Festival and asked me to audition. So I was like, well, okay, they know what I do. They really want me. I guess it'll work out. You know, like they know what they're getting if I go. And they were saying, like, we want to do your style of comedy. So, but it was the exact opposite. Like, I showed up, and it was like a room full of people with their arms folded going, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, and I've heard that from other people too. People who feel like they were pursued, and then when they got there, were told, you're going to have to scrap for every scrape, and nobody's going to tell you how it's done, and wasn't a very supportive environment. So it was a bit of a bummer. And one thing that I did there, though, was that I felt from my experience with UCB and doing bits on Conan that it was important for somebody to ground the reality in sketches. And so I was very willing to do that. And the writers were very appreciative to have somebody really doing that.
Because everyone wanted to do big, giant characters with hooks and catchphrases.
Right. And it would even be that, like, it's obvious this sketch is a vehicle for somebody's recurring character. They're coming into Starbucks to be ridiculous ordering coffee. If you're the person working at Starbucks, this is not the time to bust out your big lisp and your crazy limp and whatever. So I was willing to just be a guy at Starbucks. And the writers really appreciated it. But it ended up being that I got stuck doing that a lot. Like, I did a lot of straight man work, which is fine, but it didn't make me an important asset to the show, and it made me very easy to eliminate after a season and a half.
That's funny. There was that Damon Wayne story where when he was on SNL, and like, he just kept on, they just had him be a straight guy all the time. He was never got to do any characters. And then so he was playing a cop, and he had to just come on and say, hey, you're under arrest, until kind of end a sketch. But he came in sashaying. He was so sick of just being like a straight man. He came in sashaying, literally a straight man. And he came in going, like, in a crazy, like, you know, flaming, lispy like way. It's like, you're under arrest. Like just like totally went real big out of nowhere.
Whoa.
It had nothing to do with the bit. And then he got fired right after that.
Oh,
yeah.
No!
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, well, it is... I mean, sketch dynamic relies on a group of people working together, and the stand-up dynamic relies on essentially you trying to form this relationship with an audience. So I can see why some people fall on one side and some people fall on the other. Mm-hmm. You know, I personally like being the only one responsible for everything that I'm doing, even if that means it's not working.
Uh-huh.
But I also appreciate the fact that in an improv or in a really solid improv or sketch group, that I could go on stage, maybe not even have as strong an idea of what I want to do, but then knowing that I have this like safety net of people that we're all gonna elevate the scene.
Trust. Yeah.
Yeah, you have that sort of trust. Oh, that's what that's called.
See, I knew you were going to come up with that and finish that idea.
See, that's how it works. Yeah.
So do you when you're doing solo stuff, when you're doing solo character work that's more monologue based or more stand-up stuff, is that more comfortable, or is it all performance?
Well, the funny thing is that show that you were talking about, that IO show, that started during my second season at Mad TV when I had a notebook full of sketches that they were not letting me do.
Oh, wow.
And just having this frustrating experience and the revelation that I could take what was originally conceived of as a sketch and just do it all by myself and not have a need for anybody else in it. Just go up and do it and just take care of it. Like, that was a great feeling. And so that the album Nine Sweaters is basically, you know, that product of working that way for a long time. And I love that. I love the simplicity of that. And the reason it's called Nine Sweaters, too, is that I'm not going to get caught up in fake facial hair or any crazy costume stuff. Like, if I can't do it with just me and a microphone and a sweater, I don't want to do it.
One of the best bits, like, I still go back to, like, it's a, you know, like it's like a good song, you know, almost like I still go back and listen to it all the time, is the stand-up comic that doesn't say anything.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, like, that's... It's like one of the most brilliant things.
And I've seen people since then sort of do a version of that, uh-huh. but it's yeah. never... It's never that idea where the guy literally just sits all segues or he just doesn't yeah, say anything.
Yeah, yeah. Just has no content.
No content, yeah. Just like, and you know, you get one of those guys going, you know how they go. And I'm just like, hey, I didn't get the memo. Just like,
right. I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And then you stop halfway through to look at your notes.
Yeah.
What else is going on?
That always gets such a big reaction. And yeah. then the notes, you can't tell on the album, but the note, I pull out a totally blank piece of paper. Yeah. Just, there aren't even lines on the page, just a blank piece of white.
Which is actually, you know, like it's a funny bit to watch, and it sounds funny, and the things you say are funny, and it. But I think it's actually a really poignant commentary on, you know, whether or not you intended it to be, and not to make comedy boring by overanalyzing it. But it is, it really is like a really interesting statement on like where a lot of club comedy is, where there's people just aren't, you know, you're just trying so hard to connect with the audience. Right. Oh, hey, this guy, what is that? Oh, I don't know.
What are those places?
Well, I think that bit sort of became that. It truly started out as I just thought it'd be funny to go up on stage and talk for as long as possible and not say anything. And it wasn't in any way meant to be a statement about stand-up comedy or anything. It was just like, how long can I stand on a stage with a microphone in my hand and not stop talking but never say anything? Like, let's just see how long that can go. And I assumed it was going to be a thing where the audience was going to be furious. But they enjoyed it. And then over time, it became more about like stand-up-y hooks and having this guy be a stand-up. And then I shouldn't say his name, but I saw a stand-up, a popular touring stand-up on TV do a special. And I'm watching it going, oh, my God, that is what I did. Like, every once in a while, this comedian will settle on some true subject matter and explore it, but around the edges is just an enormous amount of, I mean, come on, I mean, seriously, I mean, really, you gotta be, I mean, what the fuck, come on, just like for a long time, just milking it for that and having that be all of it. Just like, yeah, it
wasn't me, was it?
No.
Okay, good. Guys, I want to make sure. Oh, that would have been really awkward.
It's not crazy. It does happen.
But it is, you know, it is kind of interesting that I'd be curious to see that bit in just a straight-ahead comedy club as opposed to, like, comedy nerds at UCB.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like they would still laugh at it, but probably for different reasons.
Yeah.
I've done it in all sorts of settings, and it doesn't always go over very well. I have. Apparently, so I did it at Jesse Thorne's Max FunCon, and that went great, and it was at this outdoor venue, and somebody taped it on their phone and uploaded it, which I don't mind because it's so guerrilla. Like, I really like it. And it got on Chortle in the UK and became like kind of viral over there for a little while.
Oh, wow.
So this comedian that I worked with there, this guy Omid Jalili, loved it. And when he just came to America to do a date at this big theater at this like multicultural center or something like that. And he's like, the audience is going to be mostly like Iranians and all that. And he goes, I want you to do that bit.
Oh, shit.
I don't know. Like without an audience that's like sort of on board for a parody of stand-up.
Well, I think you sort of have to under like culturally understand the medium or understand like in that being presented in that way.
Right. It was fascinating for the audience to just be like, this is the worst fucking stand-up comic I've ever seen.
Of not getting the premise of it, which you run the risk of if you're doing like character point of view stuff, because if they don't understand or buy the premise,
right,
then it's that you, if you take that layer away, then it's like, whoa, he's just a bad comp. No, but that's the
right.
You have to.
Well, I've even seen that contrast between UCB and the Melrose Improv. Sometimes I'll go and do a character bit at the Improv, and like at UCB, as soon as they understand this is essentially a sketch premise, they are on board and they enjoy it and they want to see how it plays out. But at the improv, it feels like they're just sitting there going, where are the punchlines?
Yeah.
like all that stuff in between, all that setup and all those character beats and all that stuff that might go over great.
Do you set it up at all or do you just do it?
I get introduced as the character. Yeah, I don't really set it up. I just get introduced as
I think that's hilarious. I think the main difference between, you know, like you said, if you're doing it at UCB and people are expecting that they understand, they're expecting,
right.
They also know you. There's an expectation that, oh, he's up to something.
Yes, exactly.
You Let's know, see where this goes.
I'm tittering in anticipation.
At a comedy club, what I found with that type of stuff is that, because like Mike Furman and I used to have that same problem in comedy clubs where you perform in the alternative rooms. And people would automatically go, oh, they're singing a song about patriotic dinosaurs. They must be up to something. Like, there's a thing.
Something's coming.
There's a thing, and it's coming from this point of view, as opposed to what we discovered in a comedy club, is that they are willing to go to those places, but you have to handhold them a little bit and bring them together and go, this is a thing that we're doing.
Right.
These are the rules,
mm-hmm.
and now we're going to follow those rules. Like, you... The alternative rooms will automatically figure out the rules.
Right.
The mainstream rooms need to be told what the rules are
mm-hmm.
in some way or to some degree so that then they can appreciate when you start following those rules.
Yeah, I think. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Or it just doesn't fucking matter and you're just like, oh, the people who get it and the people who don't get it.
But people like probably won't, you know, when they think of a character, they think like, just like we were saying before, you don't dress up or put on mm-hmm. any kind of weird thing. And like, you know, you're just a guy that looks like how he dresses coming up on stage. So there's no visual cue for them to assume that it's fake.
Right.
Because there's no, like, obvious fake mustache or a funny jacket.
Right.
That's sort of in this kind of, like, this sort of friendly Mormon aesthetic.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, yeah. Like, hey, guys.
Yeah. Well, you know? I just did a thing where I have this character who's running for honorary mayor of Hollywood and just gets introduced at the Melrose Improv. Like, ladies and gentlemen, this next guy coming up is actually not a comedian. He's running for honorary mayor of Hollywood and would like to have a word with you. Like, if you're not on board for a sketch at that point.
Yeah. Why is he stopping the comedy show for a political message?
Yeah, this is not the place. This is not the place for this.
We paid to see a comedy show and now some guy running for office is going to come on, are you fucking kidding
me? That was the attitude of at least half the audience. I'm like, oh, come on. And then, you know, I don't have anything that's recognizable as a joke for a little while because the premise is so silly that I'm just sort of living in the premise and in the character for a little while.
Well, I hope that, you know, for people who go to comedy shows, they do have a little bit of responsibility to, they have to come to play a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if people come and it's just sort of like the defensive, you better make me laugh. That's a little bit harder to sort of, you know, scrape those walls down. But when people come willing to play or willing to go, hey, you obviously are doing a thing and I want to go with it. So let's take the journey.
Yeah. Well, I heard a theory. One of the UCB members was saying that at the UCB, because nobody's paid more than $8, you know, they're much more willing to go with anything. Whereas, because I was complaining about my improv experience, he was like, these people have paid $22 and they've had to buy drinks and all that stuff. And so you can kind of understand them sitting there going, "All right, what's this going to be? Give me something."
Yeah.
I can
bring
back.
If you're a couple, you know? if you're on a date at a comedy club, it is not unlikely that you will spend $70 to $100 on one show after cover charges, drink minimums, any food that you guys get.
Yeah.
You know, so I do, you know, I do understand that. But I also think if you just realize that if you are willing to open up a little bit, your experience would be better.
That's
if
that's
they just assume it's like, you know, it's a comedy place. So it's not just a place for laughter, but just having fun. We're just going to go and have a good time. And people get so serious about what they want to see and how they want to see it.
Right.
At the Improv on Melrose, Brendan Small had a show, and he, like, you know, was doing music stuff in the beginning. Then a comic came out. Then he came back out as Captain Mustache, which is a stand-up commentary character. And people who – it's clearly Brendan.
Yeah.
But people just shut down completely and did not want to see it.
Really?
Yeah. And, like, it's like I saw someone lean in. I was right – that was because I was standing in the back. Someone leaned in. It's like – but the guy's just going to put on a mustache and think we don't recognize him?
Oh, what? That's unforgivable.
Yeah.
Because it just
he thinks I'm an idiot, but I'm a different kind of idiot.
Yeah, exactly.
People, we are being fleeced.
Yes.
He walks up and rips it off.
This is the man you think.
Well, I headlined the improv once and did a bunch of different characters, and one of my characters was that Life of the Party guy being belligerent to the audience, and I actually managed to upset and offend people as that character. It's like, you know, you just saw me as three other guys.
Yeah. But this is the real you, clearly.
Now you kind of start to, even though they're awful, you start to understand a little bit the mentality behind like 80s comedy headshots, because they just sort of like, they tell you what it is you're going to, like in one photograph, like,
or just like the real serious guy, like thinking about stuff.
Yeah. Maron.
I do have a headshot where my glasses are crooked, just to let people know I'm funny.
That was one of my favorite Dan Mintz things. Like the one thing he would do to further the character of Dan Mintz on stage, which he would just slightly, just like the most slight. I was like, do people recognize? He's like, I bet they do.
Or your tie is on backwards, so someone knows that it's a little crazy. It is. I think it is. It is contextual. It's one of the reasons why Furman and I stopped doing our songs in clubs, because it just felt like a comedy club. There's just an expectation of a high joker minute ratio, and sketch is weird there. And essentially, our songs were sketches, and so it's that's why we stopped doing it. We're like, you guys, you want something different than what we're doing.
Right.
You deserve something entertaining, and this is not entertaining.
No. You'd like some jokes to bring back to the office on Monday. Yeah. I get it. I don't have those.
We could go to Comic-Con, or we could go to UCB and then just fucking destroy and then go to a club, and then people are like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know? Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
Why are you doing that? So I feel like you always have some type of show or something that you're working on, or something that's in production, or something you just shot. When did that start? When did you start getting cast and stuff? Was it right after Mad TV? Did you just start? Are you one of those guys that gets a pilot every season?
Not really. I had a weird time after Mad TV. Like that was, I had a couple of years where, well, we did Crossballs in 2004. That was 2 years after I was off of. Mad TV, and Crossballs was, we made a lot of those. Did we make 24 of those for Comedy Central? That was Matt Besser's show, and it was me and Jerry Minor and Mary Birdsong and Matt Besser and Chris Tallman.
Yeah.
And that was a great show. That was a really funny show.
I got to be in a couple episodes of that show.
Oh.
Audience plant guy.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was a really great idea for a show that, particularly at that time, with the Chris Matthews style, know, like that, to satirize that. I mean, it was not far off from what The Daily Show was doing.
Mm-hmm. Or Phil Hendry.
Right.
The main difference being that Stewart is, like, he's still himself, and there's still an editorial thing, but you guys were just kind of doing the same thing, but as a comedy show.
Well, the great thing for me about that show was that, you know, the premise was we had two actors pretending to be experts on a topic, and then two actual experts, and we were debating them, so that you had to be... You had to be funny for the home viewer. You had to be comedic and ridiculous, but you also had to be real enough that the real person on stage didn't immediately go, this is bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
So that was like a super challenge. Like, oh, it's a lot of fun to do.
And how do you find those people that don't know what the show is?
Well, that was like a bridge to cross for season two, which we never got to.
Like, how do we do that?
But, and it was fine for a while. Like, they told them it was a show for MTV. I guess that was a lie.
Well, MTV Networks.
MTV Networks. I think that is probably what they said.
Yeah.
There were a lot of shows like that around that time that essentially, you know, like Daily Show or Sacha Baron Cohen style would like fuck with.
Yeah.
There was Zach Galifianakis and Andrea Savage did one where it was like a fake news show where they would go. I was basically
Man Bites Dog.
Oh, Man Bites Dog.
Yeah. It was Andrea Savage.
Good pull.
Galifianakis.
Matt Walsh.
And he writes now on Fallon.
80 miles.
80 miles.
Yeah.
That was a great show.
Good teamwork.
Yeah, yeah. But that show, Comedy Central, lost faith in it probably before it even aired. I don't know what happened, but they didn't promote it and whatever. But so that disappeared. And then I had a period of time where I made my living by appearing in the background of commercials, and some great commercials. But I was like, I wasn't extra work. It was like I was hired to be like a principal in the commercial, but somehow only ended up in the background. And I was like, wow. I would get to the end of the year and go, if it wasn't for being in the background of that M&M's commercial,
we would have been able to pay the rent.
It's a weird, it's like a showbiz odd job.
I think it's kind of good, though, because you didn't become too associated with any one thing.
Yeah,
to be like, oh, it's the Verizon guy or whatever, but you still... you're still getting residuals and you're still getting paid. So right. It's kind of a nice.
Just, you know, reacting in the background.
Yeah, it's basically like a ghost protocol for acting, where you just like disappear into the background, but you still get the benefits.
Yeah. But then what made the difference for me, I think, was UCB coming to LA and starting to do ASCAP regularly there, and casting directors coming to that, and that led directly to being Ben Franklin on The Office, and then Semi-Pro came right on the heels of that.
Oh yeah.
And then that was sort of like a new career all of a sudden.
I would love advice from... Did you ever teach?
Yeah, I taught at UCB. Yeah.
I would love advice on... Because I do see this happen at UCB as well. Mm-hmm. But it's going for the dirtiest thing you can think of immediately. Uh-huh. My brain always goes there first. And I'm always disappointed in my brain for doing that. Even though... Because, you know, it's like part of your brain's going, no, that'll get the laugh. That'll shock people. Right. But I feel like, and I don't even feel like that was necessarily the mechanism of the old man stand-up character. That just worked for that character. But I don't see you do that a lot. So I'm trying. So what is the secret to get around that toilet in your brain to the more interesting, like, oh, this is the meat of what this character would do.
Ah, that's interesting. I mean, I think you know after a while that what the reaction is going to be to that kind of thing, which is either that it's going to be so explosive that the scene can't continue, you know, like that has to be the end. You've said something so shocking that it's the end of the scene, or else the audience is going to be kind of grossed out and not on board, you know, depending on what the reference is, whatever. But I think I often feel like, You save it. Just, you know, don't start there. Save it because you might need it to get out of the scene. You know what I mean?
So you're basically just like, stashing. They're basically like smart bombs, and you're just stashing them.
Yeah. If I need to pull the ripcord on this scene, it'll be, you know, there's always pussy parts.
Yes.
The way that you said that was like someone who was in front of a Senate subcommittee on something.
Yeah, even
your head was down. It's always pussy parts. It's always pussy parts.
Under advice of my counsel, there's always pussy parts.
Let the record show.
So where does your brain go when you're in the middle of a scene and it seems like I don't really have anything for that? Like, what's your default?
Well, gosh, that's hard. But I think one thing that we learned early on in UCB days is that if you're floundering, call it out. Like, call out what's happening. Call out the game of the scene. Because sometimes it's hard to explain, but sometimes you feel like you're floundering because you're not on the same page. You know, you and your scene partner are not on the same page. And a great way to get on the same page is to be as smart as you are and analyze the moment and call out what's happening in the scene. It just sort of resets things a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
That actually does answer my question really, really well, as I'm trying to mine you for information. Because improv for me, I don't... you know, it's a team sport,
mm-hmm.
and I'm, you know, as much as I love
riffing
and collaborating and being in a room full of people, I don't know, sometimes if I'm in that type of an improv situation, I just, the stand-up instincts just take over a little too much to make it, you know, it's just that tendency to like, I gotta grab the scene and say, you know, and
well, and there are times when that works great. Like, there are times when you're like, you've clicked into a character in a situation, and it's kind of like the other person on stage knows that for them it's just about like reacting straight to this thing that's been tapped into on stage, and that so that can be fine, you know. There's that works in improv, but yeah, building a scene together through agreement is like. It's a challenging thing to learn how to do and to trust that it's going to happen. But when it happens, it's so great.
Well, and I think one of the things that I discovered about it was to get rid of the need to be funny.
Yeah.
Because the need to be funny is a very self-indulgent, selfish need. And so when you can kind of push that out of the way.
Right.
And service the pile of that each of you are throwing into, then I
feel like... The greater good.
The what? The greater good.
The greater good.
Yeah. That I have found for me that was always helpful. And even though I don't really do it that often.
Uh huh. Well, you know, there's different ways that scenes get started in ASCAT and improv in general. And a lot of the time, this is now I feel like I'm going back to my teaching days. But there are times when you come out and you explain to your scene partner what you intend this scene to be. Like, you basically tell them, here's what I'm going to be doing and here's what I think you're going to be doing in response. Like, you can do that in one line. Or there are other times when the two people come out and they don't have – it's clear pretty quickly that neither one of them came out with anything. They just came out because it was time to start a new scene. Neither of them has an idea of what to do. And that, from the back line watching, is always the most exciting scene for me, because they just have to find it. And one person will say one thing and one person will say – and then somebody will say something that they'll both understand through years of doing it is where we can start having a scene. And it's absolutely not about like – I don't know, going off on a funny riff or anything. It's just about, oh, you said something that has a specific enough detail that the two of us can mine it and walk down that road together, you know.
There's a funny thing I've, from the times that I've done monologues for ASCAP that I'll see Sean Conroy do, where it's he'll start a scene sometimes right after the monologue specifically to make fun of something that happened in the monologue.
Yeah.
Like it's like something that got a reaction because it was kind of a mistake or a misstep in what the person was saying, right. And then he comes out with like setting up a scene just as a commentary to make fun of that part. But then it becomes a completely different thing, and it's just great. It's funny to see the different types of approaches to starting a scene. Yeah. I always second guess myself a little too soon, or back off too much, and like put maybe too much weight on the other person.
I guess it's just really jokes versus situational comedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you still doing ASCAT now, or have you had time?
I haven't had time to do it in a while, but I just did it at the San Francisco Sketchfest.
Sketchfest was super great.
Fun. It was great. I had a great time there.
Yeah. So good. Were you there just past weekend?
Yeah.
Oh, we were too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I just did it Saturday night.
You don't really get to see. I made myself go to the after party on Friday night, even though I was exhausted, because I knew it was going to be the only time I was actually going to get to see other people.
Yeah, you were miserable.
I was very happy. We talked over. We did our podcast Friday night. I did four shows on Saturday. Like, we did a cartoon reading of Sanjay and Craig in the morning. Then we did the Benson Interruption.
Oh, with, yeah. I heard that was great.
Movie Interruption with Twilight New Moon.
Yeah.
It was. I'd never seen a Twilight. It was so much worse than I thought it was going to be.
But it's the greatest. It's the, like, doing a Benson Movie Interruption is the greatest way to have to see the movies that are, like, you know, cultural milestones. Well,
in the Castro Theater, which is enormous.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the thing about Twilight was that we talked over the entire 2.5 hour movie. And I still don't. I know. Like, really, really needed 2.5. You needed 2.5. Because nothing. There's like some light werewolf action happens. There's almost nothing vampire-y in the movie. Uh-huh. And a lot of it's just about, you know, you think there's going to be this thing between vampires and werewolves, and they're like, well, that doesn't fall in lines with the treaty. And then they start talking about paper, like the treaty that they have. So nothing happens. No one fucks anyone. No one really kisses anyone. Like, there's nothing. Not one thing happens in this 2.5 hour movie.
A whole movie just brooding in politics.
That's literally what it feels like. And the CG is like, you could make better CG on your phone. So it's from every angle. It's a dreadful, dreadful film. And
take that, Twilight.
Yeah, I don't care who I offend. Here's a new moon for it. Your movie sucks. We talked over the entire movie, and I don't feel like people missed anything from the movie. Like, talking over all the dialogue.
Yeah. No. I wandered into one of those by mistake, sort of. I was trying to see Inception, but it was all sold out. And the only thing, my wife and I had a babysitter. Like, we had a movie night. The only thing we could see was Twilight Eclipse.
Oh, that's adorable. We were going to make this work?
Yeah. We're out. We're doing it. What is available? Fine.
How bad could this be?
What is available? Twilight? Well, let's call the babysitter. We're coming home.
There was one scene where the female lead, she falls asleep in a tent. And the main werewolf and the main vampire have a long scene of dialogue. And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm so jealous of her for getting to sleep through this.
This is so boring. So what type of what types are you writing any movies? Are you writing, or have you just been focusing on the
television show? I've been focusing on Review. It's been a long time. I was just realizing I first signed on to do the pilot of Review 2.5 years ago.
Yeah. That's about how long it took to, for At Midnight to all come together. Right? It was about a little, about 2 years. Yeah. It just takes that long.
It does. It does. And it's been an incredible amount of fun and hard work, because I've never been like a producer before. Like, I don't know all these producerial
deals. Do you like that part?
No, I would have to say probably not. I don't like that, like, I'll step away from my emails for an hour, and then there'll be 12 of them, and they'll be about, like, the graphics font and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. And it's like, and I'll go, I don't care, but then I'll start sifting through the emails going, well, that font is terrible. Obviously, that one's better. The next thing you know, I'm fully embroiled at all of these things.
Do you have other people with you that are helping to make decisions, too?
Yes, I do, yeah.
That's helpful, because then if you, I always find that I really only ever pick things. It's usually if I have a strong opinion. This definitely not this. I really like this. But in general, I always like to think that the group is smart, smarter than I am as a whole. So if they all feel like if something sticks out to them as a group, then there's probably something that I'm missing, and I'm totally happy to go with that.
Somehow I don't seem to have that going. It's not that the people in my group aren't smart, but somehow my opinion seems to need to be heard from me.
And at the end of the day, some of the decisions you're like, is this really important? I just want to, you know.
Of course.
But someone's got to make them. Like, someone's got to pick that thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's been a lot of that for a long time. Because I was saying, like, the fun part. Like, it was super fun to write it, unbelievable fun to shoot it, and really fun to do the creative part of the editing. But that's been over for a long time. And ever since then, it's been, like, lots of little things. It's been months of little, not so much fun things.
So ultimately, how's the show formatted?
There was an Australian version of this. So this is an adaptation of an Australian series that was great and ran for 2 years there. And the premise is that it's a guy reviewing life experiences. And so people have written into him to say, what's it like to have road rage, or what's it like to be a racist, or whatever. And so he goes out into the field and does it. So the format is that in a studio, a co-host tells him what his next assignment is, and then we get to watch me walk out the stage door and then into the real world, where then it becomes a single camera kind of mockumentary as he's exploring these topics and fully immersing himself in everything.
Is he one character throughout the entire show, or are there different characters with the different challenges?
It's all one. I'm always the same guy, Forrest McNeil, life reviewer, who is exploring all of these topics to rate every life experience that he's asked about on a scale of 1 to 5 stars.
Is the premise. By the way, that's actually a really cool idea for just an actual docuseries.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Except that as we, you know, one of the things we settled on that makes this particularly hilarious is that he has an ethic that it doesn't matter what he is asked to do. He doesn't screen these questions. He doesn't choose them. They come to him, and whatever it is, he will do it. And he will do it full out as best he can. And, of course, the things that people ask about, like, we just figured logically, what are the things that somebody will say, what's it like to do this? I need to ask you because I myself can't do it, are dangerous and horrible. And so that is the major flaw in his plan of creating this show for himself. He didn't realize going in that all the questions were going to be, what's it like to do this horrible thing?
Is the rest of the world in on it? Like, if you go out and do something in public, do the people that you're interacting with know?
No.
Oh, okay.
And even his wife doesn't know. And this is not something that we explicitly explain in the show, because we also made the choice that it's not a show within a show. What you're seeing is Forrest McNeil's show as he made it and edited it and put it out there in the world. So certain kinds of points of it aren't explained explicitly, but his wife obviously knows that there's a television show and there's cameras in the house, but she, because of his ethic, his scientific approach, he cannot tell anybody, I'm doing this because I'm reviewing what it's like to steal things. you will just notice things are popping up in the house. That's all, you know, like, what? But I can't tell you why. And so he never explains anything to his wife or his children or his neighbors.
Well, that would ruin the experiment.
Exactly, it would ruin the experiment.
But if you go out in public, in other words, are there
Are there like background actors, or is it just he's interacting with real life and those people don't know that a show is being made? Like, is it sort of like Man Bites Dog?
It's fully scripted in reality, everybody is in on it. But in the reality of the show, nobody is in on it except for Forrest.
That's always a tricky thing when you're making those kind of shows where it's like a fake commercial or a fake show where it's just like you go, well, it's funny because it kind of, you see a mistake here or something breaks here or it's aware of itself. But then you go, well, wait, no, because if the people who were making this made it, they would cut that part out.
Right.
And so you have to kind of make a show as the character on top of just being a character in the show.
Yes.
And that gets real weird sometimes.
It was incredibly challenging in the writing phase because once we made that choice, this is not a show within a show, it is just his show, then every single thing that you see has to be something that he chose to put out there and would not have cut out. And it actually was incredibly challenging to get all your story points across, all the ways that this is affecting his wife and his child and his neighbors and his producer and all that, in the context exclusively of the pieces that he's put together.
Do you go in and write out all of his – do you write all of his rules down, or do you just sort of have an idea of like
– That would have been a great idea. Instead, we just found it from piece to piece and just kind of like by the end of the writing period, we had a set of rules that we all understood. Like it can't feel like a story. It has to feel like an examination of a topic. If a story creeps in there, as they do – it has to be very subtly around the edges of this topic that he's exploring. So it was challenging.
But even just what you were saying, it's sort of like, I'm sorry, I'm going to make this comparison, but it's sort of like, I don't know if you ever played Dungeons and Dragons. But
yes.
You did?
Yes.
Okay. So you really seriously did?
But Top Secret was more my like
game. Oh, fucking awesome.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so that was you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay, I'm glad we went down this path. But essentially... You pick your alignment, so you know what your moral and ethical axes are, so that in situations you know what this character would do in any kind of a situation. Well, my character is this, and you know he's lawful good, so his main thing is that he's always going to follow whatever the sort of authoritative governing law is. So for this character, you know, do you sort of go in with your alignment so you know like it, because it justifies why it's okay for him to not tell his family because he is committed to this. You know this about him. His work is incredibly important. He's doing work for society. So he is this type of alignment and that is the rule that he is following.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk from him about doing this for the good of humanity. Everything he's doing is for the good of humanity. And there's a speech in our third episode where his producer says to him, there's something he doesn't want to do. He has drawn a line and he said, I can't do this. And his producer says, you remember you told me about the guy who was growing fungus on a stick and everybody told him to stop it and it turned out to be penicillin? and he goes, this could be your penicillin.
Everybody told him to stop it.
And so, like, it's that important to him. Like, so... Yeah, no matter what it is or what it does to him or anybody else, it has to be done for the good of humanity because this show is important.
I love that I did play around with Top Secret a bit. Like, there was like right after the D&D explosion, there was Top Secret, the spy one, and then Boot Hill, which was like there was a Western one too.
Oh,
like,
I didn't do that one. I would have loved that one.
Called Boot Hill.
Yeah.
But
there weren't enough missions for Top Secret. You know, you burned them out and then you had to start writing your own.
Well, that's where I feel like it's funny to me, like, I remember in the earlier days of those games, you would buy the campaigns. Like, you would buy this little, you know, paperback campaign, and then that's what you're walking through. But I always found, like, the best Game Masters, DMs, or whatever, I don't know what you called it in Top Secret, but those, they would essentially write their own... They would write their own campaigns.
Yeah, right.
And those are always the best ones.
I have a funny story about Dungeons and Dragons. This might be the perfect audience for it.
Please.
I played it a lot with my older brother in like fifth grade, you know, and my fifth grade teacher, her husband was a guy named Harry Manfredini, who wrote the theme music for Friday the 13th. Like, he wrote the famous ch-ch-ch-ch.
Oh, wow.
He wrote that. And so he had an idea to do... record an album of soundtrack music for Dungeons and Dragons that you put on while you play Dungeons and Dragons. It's a great idea.
It's a great idea.
Right?
Yeah.
So she asked in class if anybody would come and play Dungeons and Dragons for her husband.
Oh. I got me and my friends together and went to school on a Saturday, and it was the most awkward, like, you can't even imagine how frightfully awkward it was to have this grown-up sitting there by the side watching you play.
I feel like that wouldn't be allowed now. I feel like that wouldn't be allowed now. It seems fishy.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you kids come over, play some D&D?
My husband wants to watch you play. Yeah. All right.
He likes to watch.
I sat in Chloe plays in a game once every couple months on a Sunday, and I went to her last game. It's this good buddy of ours, Matt Mercer, and his girlfriend Marisha Ray, and a few other people, and this other friend named Taliesin Jaffe. And Taliesin, by the way, was in Mr. Mom. He's the little kid with the blanket.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, he's got the whoopee.
Sweet credits.
It's fucking sweet credit. Anyway, so they play DM, and Matt is an amazing DM, and he did that. He was playing. He had all this soundtrack music playing, like, you know, it was like soundtrack to Skyrim and all these different things playing during the campaign. But his campaign was so detailed that, you know...
Yeah, the music didn't match it at times, right?
No, it did.
Oh, my God.
The music matched, but he was so good that, you know, like, oh, you found this scroll. And he would pull out, he had made a scroll, and he would hand them a thing, and they would open it up. Like, it was so fucking good.
Yeah, it should have, like, a soundboard. So it's just like, here's a scroll, like, you know, and as they read it...
It's just the wrong one. Oh, there's no machine gun.
Exactly.
Sorry, have you played recently? Or
no, it's been a long time.
Are you going to introduce your kids to D&D?
It's a good question. I don't know. Yeah,
that's a good way to have them not play it.
Yeah,
Dad tried to get us to play a game.
Come play. You're gonna play for your dad. Yeah. Bring some of your friends over.
She doesn't have much patience for board games so far. We'll find out. She's only 6 and a half.
Oh, she's only six and a half.
Yeah.
Wow, she's like a person now. It's
I know.
Strange.
Yeah, it's weird. Wow. Let's see. We have a 6.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old.
Man,
I know. That's hilarious.
She's starting to form opinions about things and have her own ideas about how stuff works.
Does she say the darndest things? Is that? I'm not sure if that was just a rumor.
She said some pretty darned things. I don't know if they're the darndest, but some darned things.
One way to find out.
Is she funny?
She is very funny, and she's very into being funny. She really cares about being funny.
Oh, wow.
Like, I definitely see in her what I used to do
at her age.
I know, no kidding. But, like, I at her age, I was watching Abbott and Costello and Warner Brothers cartoons and stuff like that, and taking notes, like, how can I apply this in my life?
And I can see her doing it. It's the same kind of shit I did. Maybe I thought everyone watched, you know, both Bugs Bunny with, like, that sort of analytical eye, like, oh, well, this Robert Clampett Bugs Bunny is different than this Chuck Jones Bugs Bunny. The jokes are different. Of, like, really... Yeah. And then the McKimson.
And also, like, I could try that on my brother.
Yeah.
I could put my brother in the Elmer Fudd position
there.
He's
thinking of that as he's getting a frying pan with his brother.
Do you do any voiceover stuff?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've been lucky enough to do some cartoons lately. I did Bob's Burgers and Adventure Time, regular show. Yeah, I've been doing a bunch of them. Super fun. Yeah. I love it.
That's a good time.
Yeah.
Does your daughter watch any of those shows?
She is heavily into something called Doc McStuffins, and also a show,
McStuffins?
It's a Disney thing.
Oh.
And also a show called Pocoyo, which I recommend to adults. It's Stephen Fry narrates it, and it's this little child and an elephant, but the funny one is the duck. The duck is hilarious.
Always is.
Pato the duck is really funny, and there's one thing, you can find it on YouTube. He dances, there's a dance off, and he dances to this dubstep music, and just, it's insane.
That's great.
It's very good. I recommend that.
Pocoyo.
Yeah, Pocoyo. Check it out. Check it out.
I will. We will check it out. So is she in school now?
Yeah. Today she's sick, but in general she's in school.
Wow.
Yeah.
You made a human being.
I know. It's crazy. Luckily, my wife is very good at parenting.
It's too scary.
You seem like fun dad.
I can be fun. Yeah, right. Yeah. I can definitely be fun dad.
Yeah, I can see
stern dad.
Yeah. I meant go to bed. Like, I can see a little.
Well,
stern.
You know what? It's true. I mean, like, my wife is very good. Obviously, there's points of conflict between the adults and the children, and my wife is very good at not resorting to that thing that my parents always resorted to, which is the because I said so. And I just, I need to get better. There are times where I just, like, we're at an impasse, and it's just because your father told you to. It feels to me like it should work.
I own you for 12 more years. You're my property, and I am telling you to do something.
But you really do have to. You kind of have to make things into a game if you want it to go smoothly.
Wow.
Right. There's a lot of that, which is fun. And when I'm on board for it, I can do it. But there are sometimes you just run out of patience. It's just like, because I need you to right now.
Yeah.
Do you ever, so you could father as a character.
Yes.
Now I'm going to do this character right. that's going to say,
get your head out of your ass and get the pants.
Get the pants on. Where to go? But yeah, no, turning things into a game and a race. I mean, it's hilarious how easy it is. Like when you tell a kid, "I need you to go over there." No, and you go, "Well, I'll race you to. Let's have a hand washing contest. See who can wash their hands first."
That's how we get Matt Myra to do things. It's a contest, Matt.
It's a contest.
You want to be better? You want to be better than Jonah, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, you win. You lost more weight than me. All right, great.
Like, she will be staunchly opposed to putting on her shoes, and it just becomes, well, let's see how fast you can turn on your shoes. And I'll take out my phone to, like, time her, and then I'll say, don't start yet. I haven't started the clock yet. And then that's hilarious. Now she starts because she's getting a jump on the clock.
Oh, jeez.
You don't remember 2 seconds ago you were staunchly opposed to putting on your shoes.
I have figured out a way to get around the wiring in your brain.
Yeah.
Do you feel any responsibility with comedy to do family friendly stuff with a family, or are you and your wife like, oh, it's comedy, you know, like the kids are gonna.
Do you show him he's bounding down?
You know, because I did do Yogi Bear, and that is the one thing I've ever done that my kid can see and that her friends can see, and that's kind of nice that you know. It's kind of nice that she has that. In general, most of what I've done, I don't think I want her to experience it until she's 30. It's all filth.
So they've not put, for instance, there's not a Kenny Powers like cereal box with Eastbound and Down toys inside for the kids. So when this comes out, are you already working on something else or is it?
No, I'm totally, I mean, I have a podcast going, but other than that, no, I'm waiting for this to come out, and this comes out in less than a month now. Yee. Review finally premieres on Comedy Central.
It must feel like, just like.
I'm so excited, and I've been sneaking episodes out, like at midnight at the UCB, and I just screened one at the San Francisco Sketch Fest on Friday night, and it's amazing to watch it with an audience, and to have this thing that I've been just been working so hard and so long on to finally get to share with people, and I understand, maybe not everybody's going to love it, but it's so exciting to put it out there and have that be part of it, like the public reaction to it is, awesome. You know, yeah.
How many episodes?
We made 9.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I can't wait.
One for each sweater?
One for each sweater. Well, we were supposed to make 8, but we ended up, of course, improvising so much on the set that we ended up with 9, a whole extra episode of fun. Yeah.
So what is the balance between the written stuff and how do you do like a written pass and then like, now everyone go crazy?
Well, this is the way we did it on Eastbound and Down, this is my favorite way to work. To have a great script that if you just shot the script, it would be a great show, but to also feel like we don't even have to get it. Like, you know, we just have just total fun, free reign to make the scenes feel, you know, like to go into a scene saying, we know the story of this scene. We can tell the story of the scene with the dialogue that was written, or we can tell the story of the scene with whatever comes to our minds or some combination of the two and just get there in multiple takes.
That was a funny thing about the first season of Eastbound and Down where it really you felt the moment where the written scene ended.
Yeah.
And then there would be this other stuff that kind of it wouldn't progress. Like all the information had already been said to have the story before, but then it would just be it's like it and now time fun. For some fun at the end.
Yeah. That show, I mean a lot of the time they did not like a lot of the time when you do a show where improv is welcome, you get the scripted version of it once and then it's like, okay, we got that, so now on one more take we can have some fun. But a lot of the time they didn't even care about getting it.
Oh wow.
They didn't even care. They were just like do what you want. Yeah, it was great fun.
Great show.
Well, we're at an hour.
Oh!
Can you believe that?
No, I can't.
Fucking
really.
Sucks, man. I want this to go on all day.
I've had to pee since minute one.
Have you?
Yeah. But
that's poor planning on your part, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
I'm a professional. Right. I'm not professional because I didn't.
I always think as an adult I'd get better at that where it's like I kind of feel like I have to pee, but I'm like, I'll just go home first. And then it just, you ruin yourself right.
Terrible.
I am constantly amazed at the stupid choices I make with things like that where time and time again I have learned that dumb to not, you know, like, oh, I should probably just. But I go, no, I don't have time. I'll just deal with it.
Yeah.
Oh, now I've completely fucked myself over. Like, that never ends.
Yeah.
No.
That never ends. You would hope that you would get smarter the older you get.
Nope. I have days that are ruined because I forgot to eat. That's right. It happens.
And you're probably those days like, why do I feel awful? Yeah. And then you have to remind yourself, I have not eaten since dinner last night. My blood sugar is crashing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need energy to do things. Yeah.
And I forget to sleep all the time.
Do you really?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just to get engrossed in things, and then because we have kids, there is wake-up time is not negotiable. That's going to happen at like 6:30 or 7.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And you better be ready, too. You better be like, ready. There's no, the kids don't understand. Like, oh, if I'm up, then you might. Like, I remember thinking, I would sort of do that thing where I wouldn't like wake my parents up directly, but I would just go in the room and just sort of walk in front of their bed. And it's like, oh, you're up now. Oh, as long as you're up.
Great.
Breakfast would be delightful.
Yes. I'll be watching cartoons.
Yeah.
Bring it to me.
Oh, did I wake you up? I didn't mean to wake you up.
Yeah.
Walking at the foot of your bed and creaking on the floor and, you know, just like heavy sighing.
Quite a few of my days begin with an argument over whether it's daytime yet or not.
What constitutes daytime?
Get into the finer points of is it daytime yet?
Well, Andy Daly, it's great to have you on the podcast, and I'm very excited that you're going to do At Midnight.
Yeah, the 26th.
When does review start?
March 6th, Thursday, 10 p.m., Comedy Central.
Thursday, 10 p.m., review, Andy Daly.
Yeah.
And Twitter, are you?
On TV's Andy Daly.
TV's Andy Daly, that's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Well, thanks. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Jonah's going to go pee. There he goes.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.